Good morning, and thank you for joining us. We are Canada Coast to Coast. I know we're going to have participants from right across the country. And I'd like to welcome everyone to Braille is Best, Everyday Strategies for Advocating for the Use of Braille. And as you know, Braille and Braille accessibility is an ongoing challenge. And today, our speakers will share their real-time strategies that have worked for them. And I know the takeaway for all of us.
Oh, hello.
Uh-oh. Is she gone?
Ooh.
Uh-oh.
Daphne?
Uh-oh, she's gone.
Where do we go to write a message, do you know, Kim? Just to see if she hears us.
I'll go into the chat in participants, and I will.
Can someone who's on mute unmute themselves to let us know if you hear us?
I hear you. Sorry, I forgot okay. I was muted. I'm like, yeah. I'll
hello.
There you go.
Oh, I don't know what happened. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, yes. You're good now.
Oh, perfect. Very good. Anyways, I just our takeaway will be strategies. And before we begin, I just wanted to let you know, everybody, that the call is being recorded. And even if I fade in and out, I hope that doesn't happen again. I don't know why it dropped. And as you know, membership for BLC is $20 a year. And this is a great time or to renew your membership if you haven't already done so, or become a new member. So I'm going to welcome our panel. Natalie, our president of Braille Literacy Canada, it will be first speaking towards our topic, followed by Kim. Kim's in Ottawa, and she is keeps us all organized with her secretarial minutes. And Jen, our final panelist, is past president of BLC. So, of course, we welcome your questions. And what we will do is each panelist will have about 15 minutes. And please hold on to your questions. And at the end of the presentation, we will circle back to those questions. And you're welcome to put them into the chat box of the Zoom there, and then of course your questions will be recorded, but hang on to them, we'll get back to you. And don't hesitate to put your hand up in to ask questions at the end. So with no further ado, I think that's all the housekeeping for this. Natalie will begin. Thanks, Natalie.
All right, thank you, Daphne. So hi, everyone. So I think I'm going to start by just providing a little bit of background on my early years as a Braille learner, and really what shaped my own views on Braille and blindness, just to provide some context on the Braille advocacy story that I'm going to be sharing with each of you. And when I was young, my parents, well, throughout my life, my parents have always been huge advocates for me throughout my education. And when I think back now, I think that's pretty incredible, because I was the first and am the only blind person in my family. And they could have easily assumed that the people around them, sighted professionals around us, knew better than they did about what I would need. But they didn't. And so they advocated for me to attend the same school as my siblings at a mainstream school. They advocated for me to learn Braille, even though I was a student with low vision at the time. And so I was learning print. And I actually used both print and Braille until my vision dropped off. But they really pushed for me to learn Braille early on. And they also pushed for me to have regular access to Braille instruction, because originally, it was kind of this assumption that I would maybe meet with a Braille teacher or TVI once a week or twice a week. And I ended up meeting with one pretty much at least four times.
Join the meeting.
Very regularly, in addition to using Braille in my classes, of course. And so because of that, when my vision eventually did drop off in high school, it didn't actually matter much. It didn't make a difference. I knew how to read Braille. I knew how to navigate on my own. I had the skills that I needed to continue living without any real disruption. And the reason I wanted to kind of provide that context is because I really feel, especially for me, and I think for all of us, that those early years really shape us. I'm going to just stop for a moment because I hear a lot of background noise. So if someone, if everyone could just check to make sure that they're muted in the app, there's a mute button, or you can press *6 to mute yourself, because I'm hearing a lot of noise. Okay, perfect.
And if you're on a PC, you do it by pressing Alt-A. And if you do want to raise your hands later, that is by pressing *9 on the phone or in the bottom corner of your app or by pressing Alt-Y. I believe it's Alt-Y.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah. Thank you, Kim.
Myself again.
Our back to mute. Expert. These are the things that I don't know, but Kim knows. All right. So basically, my parents, they really advocated for me until I was old enough to advocate for myself. And unconsciously, I picked up a lot of ideas about blindness and about my capabilities and also about Braille and equal access to information. And so I wasn't just given these practical skills, but I feel like looking back now, I appreciate that I was really kind of imbued with this like positive image of myself. And by extension, you know, the quality that I felt that I deserved just like everyone else. And this was all very subtle. My parents didn't hide the fact that I was blind or avoid mentioning it, but they also didn't make a big deal about it. I wasn't treated any differently from my siblings. There were just different things that I can remember now, my parents telling me, you know, as I grew up, that really left an impression. Like, you know, they would tell my teachers, don't judge her. Don't make decisions based on the fact that she's blind. Make decisions on who she shows herself to be. And she would, you know, my mom would say things like, if something scares you, do it more and more until it doesn't scare you anymore and hold your head up high and be proud of who you are. And that really shaped me as a person, which I think then impacted how I reacted to different situations I've encountered throughout my life. My earliest Braille memory is when I brought home a print Braille book in grade one, and it had these like tactile pictures on each page, including one that I remember of a picture of a raised hand, and I put my hand over the picture in the book, and my hand was so much smaller. And I remember just feeling so proud of this book and showing my siblings, and the fact that I could read in the night, even when my parents thought that, you know, I was sleeping. And then the other, I feel, really crucial memory I have of Braille that impacted me later on is, in the third grade, I was feeling pretty disgruntled about the fact that I had to be taken out of class to learn Braille and other skills when my other classmates didn't have to. And so my TBI actually helped me make Valentine's cards, Braille Valentine's cards for my classmates. And this was a really big hit. It actually led to several of the students coming to Braille class with me because they thought it was the coolest thing ever. And it was something that the students kind of look forward to each year. And so this is what shaped my kind of views on Braille. And I always just saw it as something I related to so many positive memories, and it made me a lifelong reader. So fast forward to college, where my story takes place. There's this kind of like transition that happens between high school and college where suddenly you don't have that same support system, but I always felt very comfortable advocating for myself. And so it wasn't ever really a conscious decision on my part to do that. I just, you know, shortly after applying for college, I contacted the disability office or the OSD, and I contacted my professors to find out what books I would need. And I would arrange that with the OSD. And this was, I'm probably the last generation that did not benefit from, you know, the iPad and iPhone and all this electronic information we now have. This was back in the scanning days. and I did that every year. And for the most part, it worked out really, really well. And then fast forward to the situation I had in grad school when I needed to take a stats course, the first of several stats courses I had to take. And I was taking this course at a university that I hadn't attended before. So I wasn't familiar with the OSD or anyone there at all. They were all new to me. I contacted them in advance and I explained that I would need to have my books in Braille because this would involve a lot of math and numbers. I knew that I absolutely needed to be able to read that information myself. I also contacted the professor in advance, and I wrongly assumed that the greatest challenge I would have would actually be in class and with the professor, because I thought back to a lot of my early math experiences when in high school, for example, teachers would use a lot of visual cues to teach math, and I always felt quite lost because of that. And so I had all this trepidation coming into the course about what that would be like, even before all these access problems started. As it turns out, the professor was incredible and did everything that he could from the start to allow me to succeed on an equal footing. He sent me all of his lecture notes and slides in advance. The disability office, on the other hand, created a whole bunch of barriers that I continue to encounter throughout the term. When I first raised my need for Braille, this launched a series of what I'll call discussions where they told me that they had another blind student once in the past who didn't need Braille. And so, you know, it could be done and that it's much quicker and easier for them to just provide me an electronic copy. And I was ticked off. There's no other way to really put it. I remember this really turning point conversation I had with the disability advisor, where I basically called him out on what I felt was a very ableist kind of response to my request. And I asked him whether the other students in the class would be expected to complete their math exams orally. And he said, oh, well, no, but, and then I'm like, okay, well, then why should I? If it's determined basically that, you know, this doesn't make sense and isn't fair treatment for the other students, why am I being held to different terms? And so this is a tactic that I find to be very, very helpful. And so it's something that I've used many times before, basically switch it around and have the other person understand the discrimination you're experiencing by putting them in your shoes, basically.
And such so a great strategy, Natalie. I'm just letting you know that's 10.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Perfect. Yeah. And I find it does help. It kind of flips it around and just gives people a sense of what it's like and how it doesn't actually make any logical sense. And I got my books on time with all of this kind of tactic I used of kind of flipping it around and being persistent. But I often would receive my exams late. And so I would show up for an exam and it wouldn't be in Braille. They'd have the electronic copy. And so I would refuse to write the exam if it wasn't there in Braille. I would literally refuse to write the exam and walk out. And I know that sounds like a very scary thing to do, especially if you're a new student. But I knew that I wouldn't succeed. It wouldn't be a reflection of my skills had I tried to do the exam orally. So I just think it's important for you to stand your ground and have a voice and know what your rights are and stick to it, basically, because you're going to be faced potentially with a lot of intimidation and people trying to compromise that, not because we have, you know, a world against us, but because I think there's a lot of educating we still need to do. So if we quickly turn to my strategies, I already provided one, but I have a few others I wanted to just briefly touch on. I think it's important to remember that whenever we're out, we're basically advocates, whether we choose to be or not, whether it's a conscious decision on our part or not. I think that when you are in a kind of like minority population, if you want to think of it that way, you might be the only blind person that someone ever meets. And I think that that's something we need to keep in mind, not because it should be our responsibility, but because we do need to be aware of what impact our words and actions have. And so remember that, you know, whether you're consciously or not trying to take on that role, the things you say do have an impact. And so if you're the kind of person who doesn't need Braille for a certain situation, I would just, suggest avoid making generalizations and saying things like, well, I succeeded without Braille, so Braille is kind of like not really needed anymore. Because it does have an impact on those of us who do choose to use Braille, and one size really doesn't fit all. So just keep that in mind as you're kind of going through your daily routine. My second strategy, I talked about flipping it around to get people to understand our perspective. But I also like to combat these negative and inaccurate ideas about blindness by or Braille specifically by changing the narrative. So I make a really conscious effort to not talk about, you know, oh, is Braille being replaced by technology? Or here are all the reasons why Braille is still relevant. Because I feel like when we use that language, we're reinforcing the fact that it's a problem. We're making people think that we think it's a problem. And I don't think that Braille is being replaced. I don't think it's under threat. And so what I choose to do, I make a very conscious effort to simply show that Braille is relevant and important by just using it in my own life. And I think that speaks louder than anything else. And then I think the other thing is that when we replace the word Braille with print, it helps people understand a little bit more. So no one would ever say, is print, you know, a thing in the past because we have all of this technology. So I like to use a lot of that language as well, rather than kind of playing into this narrative that Braille is somehow not needed anymore. And then my final strategy that I wanted to talk about is to just remember this kind of shared responsibility we all have. And here I'm talking about people who are not in the Braille or blindness community, so sighted people, and the responsibility we all have to kind of combat these misconceptions. So if you are a sighted person or professional, to just always be aware of your kind of biases and the stigma that you might hold about blindness and Braille, and a lot of it is unconscious. And try to be aware of what role you might be playing in reinforcing that. If you are in the field of blindness and you're kind of reinforcing inaccessible practices by posting things on Facebook that aren't all tagged and things like that, I think it's really important that we all take a close look at our behaviors to see what we're doing to reinforce that. Because I'm kind of the view that all of these misconceptions about Braille say a lot more about how we think about blindness, because we would never be making these statements about print. So there's a lot more I can say, but I'll stop there because I know that our other two speakers have a lot of great things to share as well, and I'll answer any questions afterwards.
Thanks so much, Natalie. That's great, great strategies. And Kim, we'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, everybody. Just in case if anyone came late and they want to know how to mute on the phone line is *6. That's the same to unmute. On the iPhone is bottom right-hand corner and Alt-A on the PC. So I was lucky to, like Natalie, Braille was really normal in our house. My mother learned Braille when I learned it, and I've been totally blind since birth. So I learned it from kindergarten, grade 1. My mom took the time to learn Braille, and she took the time to have Braille all over our house. I was the only blind person. But there was Braille on all the gifts at Christmas, not just mine, so that I could hand them out. And that was a normal thing. There was Braille labels on things. We had Braille board games, cards, and Monopoly and Scrabble and things like that. There was Braille notes on the fridge to tell me to do my chores or clean my room or do something, to Braille out a recipe so I could cook. So I really thought that Braille was cool and Braille was normal, and I didn't feel strange using it because everybody was in our house knew about it, although my mom and I were the only ones who did use it. You know, it was normal, and I had to Braille letters, thank you letters, and they would put a print underneath for relatives and all of that. So I was very lucky, and I was very motivated to read because I've always loved reading. So I learned Braille pretty fast as a young student, and I was very excited about that. And I loved writing too, creating stories and doing other things. So I really loved Braille. In grade 3, I went to School for the Blind, W. Ross, and I stayed there till grade 12. There was a lot of Braille there, a great library, and all our books were given to us in Braille. So I didn't really have to advocate for it, and I didn't really have to advocate for it at home. So I didn't think about advocating for it. I just sort of thought of it as being around. And so when I got to university, I finished high school at home, but I also had a TVI who brailled everything, and my books were in Braille. When I went to university, I moved to a new town, so I had to learn how to get around to live in the residence. I had huge classes, and I was worried about my materials and how when I would get them, and I didn't get everything right away. And when I went to the library and was handed a bunch of cassette tapes, I'm dating myself, those big boxes of tapes that had 100 million in each one, I was told, well, you're lucky you have some of your books. No, there is no Braille. You don't need it. You're okay. You're lucky. Just go with the books. And I'm ashamed to say now that I mumbled a little bit about I'd really prefer Braille, but I didn't put up a fuss about it. I just figured, suck it up and go on. Don't rock the boat. You are lucky. You'll handle it. And I went back with all the tapes, and I kind of had to learn how to listen to books. Instead, I kept using Braille as much as I possibly could. I took notes through class with Slate and Stylus and stuff, and I in a Perkins in my room and everything, and I Brailled notes, and I studied that way, and I did as much as I could, but I didn't fight for my Braille. And I thought, oh, well, because they said no other blind student, kind of what Natalie said, no other blind student does it, you know, here, you don't need it unless you're taking math, and I was taking arts and music and stuff. And no, you don't need it. And so I just left it alone, but I didn't like it, but I thought, well, maybe this is the way it is. I didn't have a community to talk to about it, really. I felt I was the only blind student when I studied music therapy. I was the first blind student to ever do that. So there was no one around me to kind of say, and we didn't have as much the online community to kind of talk to or go to BLC. And there wasn't as much Braille like in the elevators or just out in public either. So I just kind of figured, well, okay, I just have to do it. And so I finished and I got a job. And I had several jobs, and I didn't have Braille. I didn't have a Braille display. I didn't have anything. And then one of the people that worked at CNIB called me one day and said that the federal government was getting rid of some displays to get new ones, and did I want a Braille display? And I said yes. And he brought it to me, a big, big one, sit in front of my computer. We set it up,
And I realized I could do emails. I could read them in Braille. And I cried for 20 minutes. I just cried and cried because I felt it. I felt what I had lost. And I just felt it like, oh, look at all these spellings of names. I didn't know how that person spelled their name. Look at this. And how much more productive I can be. And I can do Braille. And I said at that time, I would never do without Braille again. If I had to scrape out all my money, or if I had to lobby to get a Braille display or some kind of hard copy Braille, that I felt I had lost out for years on Braille, and I would not do it again. And I haven't done it again. I really value my Braille. And I'll talk a bit about it in the workplace and in volunteering that I do. Because really, I couldn't do some of the work I do without Braille. Some of you might know I'm a storyteller, and I have several shows that I do, and I do it in schools and all over. And I'm working on a new show right now, actually, too. And I couldn't craft that material without Braille. And when I'm practicing or learning, I need that Braille to do it, to shape the words and to move them around and to craft that the stories I do. I also use it for co-hosting a radio show I co-host as a volunteer about disabilities. And I couldn't do the show without Braille because I have to read. My co-host has low vision and she can't really read on air as easily as I can because she has to hold a paper in front of her face by the microphone. I can read with my Braille display right there when we're sitting in the studio. I can read all the announcements. I can read phone numbers. I can find music and play it from my iPhone. But I couldn't do that if I wasn't. Also, I spend a lot of time in my job, in meetings, leading meetings or presentations like this. I'm reading Braille notes right now. It's a lot easier to be able to read your Braille notes, follow along in your Braille notes. Or if I'm at a meeting, I always ask for Braille documents, if possible, or electronic ahead that I can put in onto a Braille display. But I like hard copy Braille, so I can follow along with slides and with agendas. And I love that. Of course, elevator buttons. Where would we be without the Braille on the elevator buttons or the hotel rooms or the bathrooms? Definitely, where would we be without all of that? So I do feel Braille is not dead, and Braille is so important. I'm not going to ramble on too much more. I'll just give you a few more strategies. I know I'll be a bit short of time, but I've said what I want to say. My first strategy is if you want some sort of Braille device, and although the prices of Braille cells are coming down dramatically as new technologies come up, it's still expensive, and a lot of us don't have. I'm fortunate to live in a province that does have some support, but a lot of times you don't. I also did work for nonprofits and do work for nonprofits, and they can't always afford to buy you technologies. But if you can get yourself some sort of Braille device, take your time to find the one that's right for you. You try out as many as you can. So by talking to other people, so for example, for members of BLC, you could contact the BLC mailbox info@BLC, and you could ask, does anyone use a Braille display? Does anyone use this? If you're involved, a lot of you are involved in GTT, you can ask that as well. And get to know what's out there. You can also talk, maybe see them if you can get your hands on them. Some of the companies will let you borrow one for a couple of weeks. So do that if you can.
What time is it now?
129. Talk to others who have successfully advocated for Braille in school and in the workplace. So if you're in a situation like I was in when I started university,
if I'd known of others who I could talk to or talk to Natalie, what she did was just
demanded. Hi, sorry, Kim, I'm just interrupting for a second because there's a lot of background noise again.
Yeah, we need to mute.
So if you could all just check that you're muted.
Yeah,
check. We hear like dishes and things.
See if you're muted.
Star 6 if it's a phone call, and the mute button.
Bottom right in the app, or all day if you're on a computer. Okay.
Somebody's still unmuted.
So maybe Daphne, if you could just check who's unmuted.
Maybe you hear a dog in the background or something.
Mute everyone, and then I will unmute Kim. Myself. How's that?
Yeah.
Okay. It is not allowing me to mute the model.
All right.
I'm sorry. Since my device has frozen.
Can you pass one of us the torch?
I'm going to have to disconnect and reconnect. I'm so sorry. This iPad's completely frozen.
Oh, but I think that then get lost.
No, we can't do that. So I'll do my best.
We'll just continue. Yeah.
So, if you don't know how to advocate, you could try to find some people. It would have been good to talk to Natalie at the time when I was having problems, and lean on those people for support and help. And they may have written letters or done other things to help their cause. So that's another, my second strategy. My third strategy is explain in practical ways what Braille will allow you to do that a screen reader cannot, or large print cannot if you have low vision and you know Braille. Some of the things mentioned above, I cannot do a presentation as easily without Braille. I cannot attend a meeting and do my agenda, follow along without Braille. I cannot do my radio show without Braille, or whatever your tasks are. I don't know the spelling of names. I have to go letter by letter, but if I read in Braille, I'll spell your name correctly in an email. Those are my strategies, and that is all I have to say in this. But thank you so much, everybody, and I will pass it over to Jen.
This is Maurice. I'm just unmuting for 2 seconds. There's a person with a dog that seems to be unmuted. If that person could just mute himself, please, because we hear a lot of like squeaky toys and things like that, and we hear a lot of chatting. If that person can just mute himself or herself, please, that'd be appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, Daphne, did you want to say anything before I start?
Yes. Thanks, Natalie. Jen. I'm so sorry. I can't mute everybody. I am just looking down to see if I can figure out who might address their phone.
So
I'm just going to quickly run through the list. Jen, Leo, it looks like you might be needing to mute. Natalie, you're on as well as unmuted. So Irene's muted, Kim's muted. Yeah. So the only ones showing unmuted right now are Jen, Leo, Natalie, and myself. So those who aren't going to be speaking, if you could mute yourselves at this time. Thank you.
Oh, perfect. It does seem quieter now.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Jen. Thank you very much.
Okay, let me just get back to my notes here. Like Natalie and Kim, my background, I guess, is similar to theirs in that I was the only blind person in my family, still am, and I was born into a household where reading was a very big deal. My mother read to us all the time. My mother loves to read, and she definitely passed that along to us So in my childhood, I was sort of really identifying with what Natalie said about, you know, oh, my parents said my parents could have listened to the specialists, but they chose not to. My mom started out by listening to the specialists, but then she found that they were telling her all the different things that I was and wasn't going to be able to do. And she found that it just, and this isn't about, you know, trashing the specialists, but when I was born, you know, in my babyhood days, things were very different, even in terms of bedside manner and how professionals, practitioners kind of dealt with things. And if we think there's a stigma around blindness now, which I believe there is, it was even worse then. So my mother was basically told I wasn't going to be capable of much of anything. And so my mom decided she wasn't having that. She was, if I was going to struggle in school, then she was going to start teaching me as soon as I could speak, basically. So my mother started teaching me all kinds of things at home. And she was told by somebody, you know, oh, don't start teaching her Braille because you won't do it right. And my mom's like, well, tough bananas. So she did start to teach me Braille. But my mother's, I guess her whole point was that, you know, I wasn't going to get off easy because I couldn't see. I was going to be expected to do chores around the house. I was going to be raised in the same way as my sisters, my older sisters. So my mom read to us all the time, and I couldn't wait until I could read for myself because I didn't like the fact that, you know, my mom didn't have the time, or maybe her throat was bothering her. She couldn't finish reading the book that we were reading. And I really wanted to read to the end. And like, you know, Natalie and Kim, I also discovered pretty quickly that I could read under the covers without my parents knowing, until my sister told on me and I got in trouble. But I also was very fortunate in that I had good Braille instruction in school. And my mom also fought the system. And my mother really had to fight. She started when I was three, and she basically kind of stalked the superintendent of our school board. When she knew he was going to be at a meeting somewhere, she would show up. She'd written him letters and she would say, hi, I'm Ann Golden, and I'm the one that wrote you about my daughter. And I sort of sensed that eventually he gave in so that this lady would stop following him around. But she got me into public school, and I think this was one area where she did listen to the specialists, because she was told, okay, your daughter's going to learn Braille. And my mother never questioned that. My mother never thought, oh, I don't know if that's a good idea. I think for her, it was just very, she knew that reading was obviously of utmost importance, and that was the way that I had to read. So then Braille it would be. And, you know, I had all my stuff in Braille, although in high school, I did sometimes have audio just because, again, because of the time period that it was, I was often the first student needing something and time was an issue. And I didn't like it, but I guess I knew that none of us did. My mom didn't like it. Now she'd be a TDI. Then it was a different title, but you know, she didn't approve of it either. So when I did get audio, it wasn't like, oh yeah, here, take audio because it's just as good. It was like, we're really sorry, but we can only get this in audio right now. And so I came to expect that Braille was kind of my due in life when it came to accessing information, because that's what I was taught to believe. And I very quickly figured out, well, not very quickly, but in high school, I figured out that I'm not an auditory learner. So I don't retain things as well if I have to listen to them as opposed to reading them. And that really helped cement my understanding of, you know, what I needed and why I needed it, which I'll kind of tie back in when I get to my strategies. But I don't remember a lot about learning to read. And people often ask about, oh, is it really hard to learn Braille? I don't remember. The only thing I remember about learning to read is I remember reading a bunch of phrases. And one of them was, I have a puppy. And I remember looking up at the TVI and saying, surely there, like, I didn't say it like this, but there has to be more than this. Like, I don't want to be just reading I Have a Puppy. Like, can I please have books already? So eventually I did get books. And I remember, this is kind of more of an from when I was an adult, but a few years ago, someone that I is that I met basically questioned contracted Braille. And so I think we should just get rid of contractions. And after I picked myself off the floor and got my heart beating again, I thought, I'm going to ask my mother how she felt about that, because this woman was saying, oh, it's too hard for my kids to learn or whatever. So I asked my mom, I said, Mom, what did you think when they said, you know, she's going to learn Braille and there's, you know, contractions and she'll have to learn it? My mother's, well, her first response was, well, I didn't have to learn it. You did. So I wasn't really that concerned. And then she said, you know, partly it was, yeah, that she understood that that was what I needed. And she said also that my mother was trained, my mother is a secretary by trade. And she said, well, I learned shorthand. So I thought if I could learn shorthand, surely you could learn these contractions that they said you would use all the time. So that my mother's attitude was just, I thought, very common sense about Braille. And she said, nobody talked about like, oh, Braille is really hard and all these other things. They just said, this is how blind people read. So that was kind of the end of the story for my mom. She just went with it. My mother actually did. She does know Braille. And in the days before texting and electronic stuff, I got hard copy Braille letters from my mother when I first went away to university. And it was really neat. I actually kept them all because I didn't get a lot of hard copy Braille letters. So that kind of brings me to my advocacy scenario that I'm going to talk about. And it's like Kim and Natalie, it is a university kind of academic thing, but I want to make it clear that I think, as with everything that Kim and Natalie said, I think it can tie into other areas of our lives where we need to be advocates. So the scenario is academic, but I don't think that the strategies or that the principles are limited to that. So when I went away to university in the fall, I kind of did the same thing that Natalie did, where I contacted the student services department before, you know, as soon as I knew I was accepted. And actually, I think even before, I said, I need to find this out as soon as I can, because I understand that, you know, there needs to be, there's a lot of time involved in getting the books. And so I did try to be proactive. Unfortunately, one of my problems was that I had such good Braille support in elementary school and high school that it didn't occur to me that it would be different in university, because I guess because I had been raised to think that there was no question that Braille was what I needed. So I got to university, and the first week of school, you know, I had done this follow-up, and I went in and I said, okay, I'm here to get my books and find out what else, if you need me to do anything else. And they kind of said, oh, well, we didn't think you were going to really take a full course load. I mean, blind people don't take a full course load. So we just looked at getting books for these three courses. I said, yeah, but I'm taking five. And they said, oh, and you know, you're going to have audio because that's just easier and it's better. And kind of, again, same thing as what happened with Kim and Natalie. Only, as my family will tell you, I am very stubborn. And unfortunately, then I was not only very stubborn, but, you know, 19 and not maybe the most mature person out there. So I may not have always dealt with the situation as I could have. But the one thing I did do, which, you know, I'm glad I did, I pushed back. I said, no, you need to get this for me in Braille. I need this in Braille. Like, I couldn't even believe that they were suggesting this audio option. And I did everything that I could think of to do at the time to sort of advocate for my own Braille. I'm just going to pause really briefly. I know someone joined, and I'm not sure who it is, but I'll just let you know that if you need, we're kind of asking everyone to mute themselves. So it's star six if you're on a phone, and if you're, I learned all this from Kim. If you are using an iPhone, it's in the bottom right corner. If you're on a computer, it's alt A. I think I've covered all of it, but Kim, feel free to unmute and clarify if I've missed anything. But okay, well, Kim is not jumping in, so I guess I learned well from her. So I very quickly figured out in university that I was going to need to be my own advocate, because I didn't have a TVI. I didn't have anybody who was really on my side in this, which was kind of isolating, actually. So to Kim's comment about, you know, being able to talk to people in the community, I didn't really have any blind friends. And you know, my family was very supportive, but they weren't there with me. And I'd been sort of raised to like, okay, we raised you, you're on your own now, kind of, you know, not in a bad way, but I could tell my mother what was going on, but there was kind of little that she could actually do. So I would say that in my initial days of sort of being my own advocate, and I think sort of being an advocate, you know, kind of ran in my veins, I think, just because when I look at the way my mom fought for me when I was a kid, I found that my initial just sort of arguing and insisting like, no, I want Braille. No, I want Braille. No, I want Braille. Well, yes, I was pushing back and I was fighting for myself. It wasn't really that effective to just do that. And I guess this is kind of, you know, going into what worked, what didn't work, and what I would do differently. I would say one of the things if I regret anything about that time, is that I wish I had, I was angry. I think because I was scared. I was afraid I was going to fail because I didn't have textbooks. And I had always done well in school. And so the idea of failing was horrific to me. Like I couldn't even contemplate that this would happen. So I sort of reacted out of my anger, which when I get to my strategies in a minute, my view of advocacy is that you can't do it out of anger, because the minute you become that angry blind person or that angry whatever you're advocating for, you lose people. Yeah, sometimes people do accomplish things and they're really angry and you know, people sort of give into them. But I'm sure that if my mom had shown up at these board meetings where she found the superintendent, if she had yelled at him and ranted, I'm pretty sure she wouldn't have been as successful as she ultimately was. So I found that, you know, getting angry and going and complaining to, I actually ended up talking to my res advisor and just, you know, ranting. And yeah, I was frustrated and yeah, he listened, but that wasn't really the most productive thing. So what did I do that was productive that I think was really helpful? Well, I wasn't getting any, you know, support from student services. So I ended up going to talk to somebody in interlibrary loan. I don't even know how I ended up talking to her or what made me think of it or how that connection happened, but she was wonderful. This woman, I think initially I went to her because I was looking for a German textbook. And I said, I absolutely have to have this in Braille. Like I cannot learn this language without having a Braille book. And she got it. I didn't even have to convince her. She's like, yeah, absolutely you do. She actually drove it to my apartment. Like she was just above and beyond. And I'm forever grateful to her because she actually, not only did she help me, but she made me realize that I really probably could get what I wanted if I was willing to be a little bit creative and to be persistent and to try to think outside the box. So I would say, you know, if you don't get what you want the first time, try asking somebody else. That actually did, eventually you find someone who will listen. And I, too, like Natalie, I did go to my professors and I started just dealing with them directly because I found that, and this kind of ties into my first strategy actually, that, you know, knowing what you need and why you need it is a huge step towards being able to get what you want. Because if you don't really know what you need, feel free to just jump in, Daphne, when I get to 10 minutes.
Yes, and you're just there.
Just there? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Great. So, you know, my initial advocacy for myself, like I said, was just, no, I want Braille. No, I want Braille. But if I could have said, I want Braille, I need Braille, here's why I need Braille. And even if I had been more specific when I had initially started my conversations with the Disability Services Center, I can't remember whether I said, you know, I need my books in Braille or I'm sure I did, but I could have been much more specific, I think. And one of the things, you know, when you know what you need and you know why you need it and you can convey that information articulate way, you're going to be able to go a lot further in the way of convincing somebody, whether it's at a university or whether it's, you know, you're attending a meeting and you want the agenda in Braille. If you understand the issues too, I do admit that when I was insisting on Braille, I actually had I knew it took longer to get Braille. I wasn't dumb. I realized it cost money, but I actually didn't know anything about the much about the process of transcription or of, you know, what would be involved on the part of the disability services center or whatever. I find that it's actually helpful when you can go in and you can say, look, I know this is what's involved. I know you need to do this and I know you need to do that. And here's what I think would work in this situation. So maybe you can eliminate this step or that step, or, you know, at least kind of try to collaborate instead of feel like you're going in and you're, you know, it's me against you. Cause that's definitely how I felt. I felt like it was an us and them thing.
I don't want to say no one is ever going to advocate for you, but no one can advocate for you like you can.
And I think kind of to tie this into my second strategy too, that, you know, if you can express what you need, why you need it, if you can be proactive, you know, I made the mistake of assuming that Braille was kind of just going to be there because that's sort of how it had been. Definitely be proactive. If you know there's a situation coming up where you think, you know what, I'm going to want Braille for this, then kind of get on it as soon as you can. Because the reality is that even in this day and age with all the technology we have, it doesn't happen the day of. Unless you work in a very specific environment, or you're, you know, there's very specific circumstances where it does, but for the most part, time is involved. And so your request should, you should make your request as soon as you can. The other thing that I would say, and Kim touched on this a bit too, but being strategic in the way that you think about accessing Braille. So kind of an epilogue to my school experiences where I felt like everything was a battle because nothing was electronic then. Like it was really hard to get anything. And I ended up in my fourth year getting a loan from the bank, buying a scanner so that I could at least buy print textbooks and scan them and take notes while I listened, which was a pain. I wouldn't do that again now, but that was kind of my only option then to get what I needed. Now I'm actually studying again and I get a lot of my stuff the way anybody else would. I go on the library, I download a PDF, as long as it's text-based. If it's not, then I do have to request a transcription service. But I make a point to tell them that yes, I'm accepting a PDF or a Word file, but I'm actually reading it in Braille because I have a Braille display. And I do that, it's kind of the principle for me. I want them to know that technology isn't replacing Braille. And like Natalie, I don't want to engage that debate, but I do want them to know that, yeah, I may not be asking you for an actual Braille transcription, but I am reading this document in Braille. And I think where that comes from is that I don't see Braille as a luxury. I didn't really put that as a strategy, but if you go into a situation, print readers don't think of print as a luxury. So why should we think of Braille as a luxury? And I think if you have that mindset and that viewpoint that this isn't just a bonus, that wouldn't it be nice if somebody gave me Braille? If you thought of it as a necessity, I think your approach to advocacy will be very different. And again, this is sort of a day and age where we don't always necessarily have to get a Braille sometimes a Braille transcription, you do need that. You need it to be formatted properly so it makes sense. You need someone to write transcriber's notes for the images and make sure the tables are transcribed properly. But there are times where you can figure out ways to get your own Braille. You can, you know, even if it's like you download Braille Blaster, which is a free translation software. Maybe you download Braille Blaster and you teach yourself how to do a little bit of basic Braille transcription. There's a lot of things you can do in the way of getting Braille that don't always even involve advocacy in the traditional sense. So that's kind of, I feel like I kind of got off my point a little bit, but I guess if I could leave people with one thing, it's just be persistent. Know that you're not asking for something that is above and beyond what anybody else would ask for themselves, just equal access to information.
Oh gosh, Jen, thank you. And it's such great practical ideas from the three of you, Natalie and Kim and Jen. I wish I'd had all this information before I set out on my teaching career, because all these are such important takeaways for parents advocating for their child from early days and creating that positive energy to make self-advocating something that is a matter of course, but something that is done with the eloquence and the humor and yet the persistence that the three of you totally demonstrated. I'm just looking at our participants and I see Marlies has her hand up. So at this point, we'd like to open up for questions to our three panelists. And perhaps as you go to, I'll unmute everybody at this time. And I would like everyone to please just say your name before you start talking so that we know who's speaking. Thank you all. And Marlies, go ahead.
Hi, it's Marlies. Yes, Daphne, thank you. Jen and I were in the same town. We were born in the same town. So I think, Jen, I know who you're talking about when you talk about the superintendent. My mom had some encounters with him. But yes, I don't want to talk about my background, but basically I was sort of in the same situation as Jen, where I was the first Franco-Ontarian actually to benefit from schooling in a regular school with specialized services like Jen. So we had the same TBI.
Yes, definitely.
But and again, I think like the three of you said, I think Braille is not obsolete whatsoever. I think it's, and I always tell people, if people tell me, well, you know, Braille is not, it's not in anymore, let's put it that way. It's not the I tell them, well, you know, would you give an iPad to a grade one student and ask him to read and write with the iPad? And they say, well, no, we give him paper and pencil. I said, well, Braille for me is the paper and pencil, of the blind. So I think Braille is a very important tool to have. And I think Jen and I just discussed this a while back, but I know there's been studies where it was shown that actually Braille, people who read and write Braille succeed more in finding jobs and that kind of thing, and are more literate, let's put it that way, than people who, and I mean, I'm putting literate in very big quotes here, but they're more, the grammar is better, their sentence structure is better than those who do not know Braille, who did not learn it for X number of reasons. So that was my my point, but I'm really glad that you girls actually, I think we're all on the same page here in terms of strategies and in terms of advocacy.
I have a question. I have a question for Natalie. When you walked out of the exam, were there repercussions? Like, did you get to take it again? Like, because that is sticking your neck out. Like, I think it's pretty great you did that. But how would you then approach? Like, if you do have to get to that place, mm-hmm. how do you still get to pass your course and do the rest of it?
Yeah, and you know, for people who know me, I mean, I'm a strong advocate. I know how to communicate for myself, but I'm also not what one would call militant. I like to be nice to everyone. and so, but the thing is that I think partially because of just how I was raised and everything around that, I had requested Braille for my exam. So it's not like I got to the exam and I wanted Braille and it wasn't there. This was something that was negotiated as part of the accommodation contract. And so I had a foot to stand on. And I think that makes it different from a situation where you know, I'm bringing up something that nobody knew about in the first place. So I kind of felt like I followed my side of the contract, and I contacted everyone I needed to in advance and did what I had to do. And then there was no follow through. So that made me feel more confident about how I acted in that situation. And it wasn't something that I thought about in advance, because I thought I would get there and there would be Braille. And so it was a very kind of instinctual thing for me to do. When I got there and I saw that there wasn't any Braille, I said, I can't write this exam. Remember that we're talking about a math exam. So, you know, again, no other student would have to do it orally unless that was their accommodation request. So the way this usually works in the university context is that, you know, there are invigilators who are usually students hired to watch you as you write your exam. And so there wasn't actually anyone, any advisor there, because we were writing in a separate building. And so there was no one that I could speak to directly that morning. And so I think I gave the poor undergrad student a little bit of heart failure.
Good for you.
And I explained it to them, and I agree with Jen. I think you really have to, rather than just automatically moving to a place of anger, you have to be very, very clear and concrete about your reasons. And I did what I had to do. So in advance, so I left a message for the advisor and the professor, and I knew that the professor understood in advance that I needed Braille and that I would have their support. So I felt empowered to do that. And I think that goes back to what the other two, you know, Kim and Jen said, know who is available as resources, so that you feel more empowered when these things come up.
It's great.
But there were no repercussions. I wrote the exam later on in Braille. I wrote it later than the other students, but I got to write it in Braille.
Awesome. Yeah. Can I just, this is Jen, I just wanted to make a quick comment, because I think all three of us mentioned, you know, not really having access. Actually, Natalie, I don't know if you did, but I know Kim and I both, you know, we sort of talked about, like, we didn't really have anybody to talk to, you know, in terms of, like, I didn't have a blind person I could go to who would say, you know what, that happened to me too, and here's what I did. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important, because as supportive as my family was and my TVI, like, but it's different when you can talk to somebody who had to do it for themselves, and they can say, look, this worked, this didn't, you know, make it your own. You can't use Jen Golden's exact approach or Natalie Martinello's or whatever, but here's what I did, and you're not crazy. Because sometimes I started thinking, like, am I being too demanding? Mm-hmm. Am I being unreasonable? But you know what? I wasn't. I maybe wasn't always the politest negotiator, but what I was asking for was not unreasonable at all. And if I had someone that could have said to me, no, I needed the same thing, keep going. And I think now people can have that, you know, people can, even if they contact BLC and we put them in touch, or we talk to them, or we put them in touch with somebody who's been there. I'd love to encourage a student to stick to it and push for Braille. I would thoroughly enjoy that.
And I think too, if we do that, when we say that, like when we are emotional and we're talking to another Braille reader, we can then advocate in a clear, like, calm way. We can get that. Jen talked about anger and, you know, whatever, maybe go off. You could do it in a different way. Like, not as, you know, you get that emotion out, and then you can do it in a really clear way.
That's so true, Kim. I'm just looking too. Irene's put her hand up as well.
Yes, thank you very much. Lovely to hear you ladies. And didn't get through the same problems at university, but I dealt with audio because Braille was just not available to me. So the learning curve is much, much facilitated by the use of Braille for me. Personally, 100%. My favorite story of the week is I am working with a deafblind person out of Southern California, and he's profoundly deaf, so he can use, he's got an iPhone, and my response to him, instead of getting angry that he can't come up with the money to get a Braille display to be able to communicate, because blind is tough, but deafblind has to be just about the most ultimate lack of communication that there is. It must be very isolating. What we're doing is, I explained to him how he had to approach these charitable foundations who hand out Braille displays to make sure that it's politely aggressive, to make sure they understand that as a deafblind person, he really needs this kind of support. Yeah. So he's getting us, to my knowledge, he's getting a Focus 40 Braille display to work with his Duolingo. I use Duolingo, that's a language learning app. I used that about 5 years ago without a Braille display. And thank you to Kim and David. The use of the Braille display with Duolingo in studying Spanish is an absolute miracle, because there's no way that that single finger flick or letter by letter or the voice is going to give you the kind of information that the spelling and the accents that the Braille display is allowing us. So my friend and I are trading lessons on Duolingo for lessons on the Focus 40 Braille display. So I think
that's awesome.
Thanks to Kim and David.
That is awesome. And you know, I just want to address one more myth. I think all of us are long-term Braille readers, but I hear over and over again from people who come to get help from us who are older, and they say, oh, Braille's going to be too hard. People say, oh, I don't have to do that's too hard. Like, I really want to address that you don't have to read a book, but reading those elevator buttons or the bathrooms or the floor levels on our LRT here, where you are, what level you're on when you come out of a station, because they have Braille all over that. You know, even that, and I really don't like the fact that people are also saying that Braille is too hard, and it is like learning a language or a skill, but I really hope we get away. We encourage people instead of discouraging them from starting on the Braille path. I worry about that sometimes.
I think it's a really good point you mentioned, Kim, because like I've kind of going back to switching the conversation, like there's nothing inherently easier about print letters. There's like, they're completely arbitrary. Like the way an A or a B or a C looks, there's no logic to the print alphabet. There is a logic to Braille. We know kind of like the format that you follow every 10 letters. So it's like, it's funny that people think that, you know, Braille would be hard to learn, because of course everything is harder to learn when you're older, but that is not a question of Braille. That's a question of you need to devote the time to learn it, but there's actually nothing inherently harder about the Braille letters.
No. One thing I would say too, it's not so much an advocacy strategy, but a way if you're trying to get access to a Braille display, you know, especially if you don't live in Ontario that has ADP, and I don't know what every province is like, but something that I've done a lot is, you know, the internet can be a wonderful thing. I've found secondhand Braille displays, or even, you laugh, but eBay, Kijiji, sometimes people are wanting to get rid of Braille displays because they had like a relative who died and they don't know what to do with it. And they'll sell it for a song, like, because they don't necessarily realize the value of it. So I would say, like, think outside the box, look online, see, just, you know, you never know. And, you know, an example that someone contacted us recently looking for a way to get a Braille display, and I asked them, you know, to look into what their province offered, and they came back and they said, well, the only way I can get a Braille display is if I'm either in school or if I work or if I volunteer, and I'm not doing any of those things. And my initial reaction was, okay, I get you can't just like up and go back to school, or up and, you know, you may not be able to get a job, but then volunteer. Like, mm-hmm. If all you have to do is volunteer a few hours a week and you're eligible for a Braille display, That's a great idea. Take advantage of it.
Yeah, such great advice. I see Louise has her hand up.
That you don't need. Let us know, because we're happy to facilitate things like that. We can rehome unused braillers and braille displays.
Such a good point. Louise, you have your hand up. Would you like to jump in there?
Okay, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, I'm making sure. Okay, I'm the opposite way, because I had too much vision when I started school, but I read large print, and my head was always in the book. And I didn't learn to read properly. So by the time I started learning Braille as an adult, it became a handicap to learn it. So I encourage and would encourage anybody to learn Braille as a child. Even if I had learned it as a child, it might have helped me as a background like Natalie had. Because as I lost my vision, it would have come in handy and I would have just jumped into life using it. But I learned it as an adult. And because I couldn't spell properly and didn't know what words were, because I went out to audio by the time I was a teenager more than anything, because it was faster for the teacher to give me audio or an itinerary teacher to read me verbally stuff. Mm-hmm. So I fell through the cracks in some way with Braille, because you can only read a few words at a time and you can't comprehend what you're reading. And it's still the way with Braille to this day.
Yeah. Almost all low vision people, Louise, the only one I've heard of is Jen Jessel, who learned it as a kid. I haven't heard of anyone else. And they all tell me now they wish they'd learned it as a kid.
You know, that's such a great takeaway message for TVIs. I think we struggle at times with, should we go and have Braille taught at a young age, and I mean it's a really good message to hear, because I think having that option is so important for our students.
And the worst part was I was seeing a Jericho Hill School for the Blind in Vancouver here, and everybody else around me was learning Braille and I wasn't, which made me feel different.
Well, I wonder why they didn't teach you Braille.
Because they said I had too much vision. And my parents didn't encourage it, you know, because my mom tried to learn it as an adult, as a person, and she got headaches from reading it because she was using her eyes because she had too much vision and she was cheating all the time. So she decided it was not good for me to learn it as a low vision person. So it was a whole bunch of little things put together, but I'll tell you, I felt different among my peers at the first 3 years of my education, because I didn't have Braille in my hands.
Wow. I have a response, but I want to make sure there isn't anyone else who wants to talk.
Nope, there's no other hands up there. Yeah, thank you.
I just thanks for sharing that, Louise, because I find we're kind of having like a side conversation about the emotions attached to advocacy and feeling excluded and all of that. And all of us touched on, you know, it's important to push through the anger and the discouragement you feel so that you can communicate what your needs are very clearly. And that's true. It is very important. You have to kind of, I always think of it as powering up. Like whenever I am kind of encountering a situation where I feel like I'm being somehow treated differently or, you know, not having equal access. It's like powering up. It's almost like you're putting all your emotions aside and kind of putting on your armor and dealing with the situation. So, but I think that we also, in case there's anyone listening here who's in the process of learning Braille, like as an adult, I think it's also important that what we're saying isn't misinterpreted as, if you have these emotions, that it's a bad thing. Because especially if you're like still in the process of losing your vision and you're learning Braille and it's new to you, you're dealing with all of that adjustment. And even those of us who have been blind since birth, you know, there are times when we kind of push up against barriers in society, and we're just like, I'm so fed up, right? That happens. So I just don't want to kind of, and I don't think any of us are doing this intentionally, but I want to make sure for those of you who might be newer to vision loss, that if you're having those emotions, that's okay. And I think it goes back to what Jen said about having other people in the community to talk to, because unfortunately, adults tend to learn Braille alone. That's how rehab works. And so then you don't have anyone to compare to, like, oh, am I learning really slowly? And am I the only one who can't do it? And I think it's really, really helpful as a strategy to feel empowered, because when you work, when you have other Braille learners to talk to, you have that context to compare, but you also might be in a position where you might be able to help someone and realize, like, hey, I actually can do this. So that's all I wanted to say in response to Louise's story.
Thanks, yeah. Natalie. I'm just looking down the list of hands raised, and I don't see anybody who has just put up their hand. Is there anyone else who would like to ask a question?
Irene has one quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Could somebody give me a short answer? The game called UNO is apparently a card game. I'm absolutely clueless about it. Most card games I am. And apparently the company that produces UNO, I think it's Mattel, has provided these cards are available in the stores in the United States, the Target stores in the United States. Are they available in Canada? Is there a place to buy a deck of UNO cards in Braille?
I've seen UNO Braille for years. I would think the Braille Superstore would have it, Irene.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
So, or you might have to order it online from...
Maybe through Amazon. Who knows? If you want to buy directly from, a regular store.
Because I think it's...
rehab.
Yeah. I think it's a wonderful opportunity. The granddaughter doesn't have a visual impairment, but a wonderful opportunity for a card game that she wants to play and to develop my skills as a card player by having access to the Braille cards and giving her access to how a blind person develop skills by using Braille.
And that's a good game because it has like a lot of different letters you would practice. Like the colors are like Y, G, R, like whatever the other one, blue, and then B, and then there'd be skip would be S. And so it is good because it's not overwhelming in terms of what's on the cards.
I'm just looking at the Braille Superstore, and it's available for Canadian dollars at $18.55. So $18.55.
What a moderator she is. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Daphne, and spot research.
Daphne, I had my hand up, but I don't know if it worked.
It does work. But what's happening, this is me learning how to use the Zoom platform. The hand doesn't disappear when a person speaks. I need to jump in and do that.
I do my own. Just a minute. I'm trying to lower. Tap to change.
Anyways, go ahead, Jen.
The thing that I wanted to say, and again, it's kind of going back to Louise and to Natalie's response. One of the things that I hear a lot, and I think people who have sort of been Braille readers, like lifelong Braille readers, people will, you're talking to somebody who learned Braille later and they'll say, I'm not a Braille reader like you. Like I don't, I can't read fast. And it makes me so sad when I hear that because I feel like there's this divide that people think that, I think I'm better than you because I read faster or whatever. And I think I just want to say that for people that learn Braille later and struggle with it, we're all on the same team. Like we support you 100% and we're not thinking, oh my goodness, what's wrong with them? They're not a real Braille reader. Like what the heck? I mean, when I learned Braille, we all start out slowly and learning the letters and being new to it. I might've been younger and, I may have been reading it longer, but I just feel that it's unfortunate that we in the community that that dichotomy comes up, that it's like there's the real Braille readers and then there's the, you know, then there's us. And I just don't, I wouldn't want anyone to think that that's what we're all sitting around thinking, because we're on the same team.
Here, here.
Yeah. We're just happy people are doing it. And I think it's like when you learn a language, like my French is not that good and I'm very self-conscious and I think people don't want to listen to me talk in French. But when I do, people are supportive of that. So we think we're hard on ourselves too, to think because it's not something we learned when we were tiny, we're not as fast or we're not as agile with it. And it doesn't matter. Like, I get self-conscious about languages and I know people around me say, well, you're so good and you're so easy reader. And, you know, but I'm just glad when people are reading Braille. I just am happy about that.
And if Braille is doing what it needs to do in your life, then you're a Braille user. It doesn't matter how many words per minute you read.
Even if it's, you know, I read the elevators and the hotel room doors and the,
want to get their attention. Excuse me? How do we raise our hand when we're on the phone? I can't remember.
Oh, there are nine, but just go ahead.
Go ahead, Peg.
Lynn has a story to tell.
Hi there, it's Lynn from Vancouver, Peg's roommate. I'm going to make this very short. I decided to learn Braille because of the fact that the parents in Victoria were learning it because they thought that the administrator... they decided to do a class for them, and my dad really got into it, and then I really got into it. And maybe sometime I can tell a little bit more, but to make it very short. And I would advise anybody if they have sight still to start learning it because it'll be help you later.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Yep. Yeah.
Good point. Thanks Lynn.
Yeah. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if Natalie or Jen or if anyone knows, but I remember talking to people that went to schools in England, schools for the blind, like in the 50s and the 40s and that, and they all learned it. And I know someone with low vision who learned it, and she said, you know, they had to learn it. It was something they learned, and she lost more vision, and she was really glad that she had learned it as a kid. You know, and I don't know if that was always the case or she just happened on a school like that, but it's almost like, yeah, I don't know. And I mean, I guess Daphne's been the teacher most recently, but I don't know why they don't just say, all right, this is a tool in your toolbox. You might need it someday.
You know, I think there's a bigger move towards that now, Kim, certainly than the 40 years ago when I first started teaching. Now, using the learning media assessment, teachers and parents and administrators are realizing, hey, there's really value to having as many tools available to the student. And as you've pointed out, one size doesn't fit all. And that's so true with not every job is going to be a Braille job. Some jobs can be done with enlarged print or audio for our dual media users. So I think it's so great when kids have the opportunity to have exposure to learning the code. Such wonderful points in building advocacy for the importance of Braille in everyday use and in schools and university. I'm looking at hands that are raised. Louise, I see your hands raised and also Marlies. Did you, either of you have another point or is that, have we covered that off?
No, Daphne, thanks. I think I didn't put my, how do you put your hand down?
If you tap, are you on your iPhone, Marie?
I'm on my computer actually.
I think it's all Y again, perhaps.
Okay, let me just try that and see, because I have no anything to add, but it's just, let me, oops, okay, I'm doing all Y, but it doesn't seem to.
No, it's still up, yeah.
I can't remember.
Oh, there we go.
That worked, You did it, Marlies.
Thank you.
Yep, yeah. And Louise, have you got anything that you wanted to add?
No, I tried the same thing to put my hand down and it wouldn't go down. But no, what I was going to say is thank you, Natalie, and all, because we all struggle. I mean, audio is my best friend from the time I was a teenager, and it's helped me learn voiceover. It's helped me learn speech and be able to sit and listen to it for hours. So, I mean, though I didn't learn Braille early enough, the other technology is there. So it doesn't matter what technology we use. We have to advocate for that technology to be in our lives.
Yeah. So you have the choice.
You have the choice. And I think Braille is part of my choice, but it's not as strong a choice.
Yeah.
And, but at least you could choose. When you choose a method that works for what you're doing.
And it's chosen on how I was brought up. And that's important too. When someone's sitting there saying, well, I listen better, then help them learn to listen and use their fingers going along with it. Mm. You know, use what a person's strength is to help them learn the other strengths to become strong in all.
Yeah, such a good point.
Yeah, exactly.
Just one comment about card games. Other than Uno, another game that I know my students enjoyed in the past was playing Crazy Eights, and that can be just done with a regular set of Braille playing cards. So that's a quick if you have Braille playing cards handy, that's great.
And you also can even dominoes. You can even Braille them too. So we had some distant relative that was a bit of a card shark, we think, because he kept having all these decks of cards. And I just roll them into Perkins and do it myself.
Yeah, good.
So you can Braille your own if you want to. And you can Braille other games too. You know, you can.
I wanted to just point out for everyone who is participating today that you'll be getting a survey by email. And that's just to get your feedback on this workshop, because we're always trying to improve. And also we ask there if you have ideas for future workshops. So if there's anything we talked about today that you would like to hear more about in detail, or if you have other ideas, just let us know, because that feedback is really important for us for organizing future workshops.
And we are going to be organizing special things for new Braille readers at some point too. We know that that's a need.
Yes. So stay tuned. It's a surprise. Yeah.
So our next teleconference, I guess, will be in January, early in January. Year.
Yeah.
So stay tuned, everybody, to see the announcement for that. And if you wanted to have the audio recording for this, that also will be available for our participants. So you may want to go back and hear some of those really great strategies and thoughts that came out of today's teleconference. And I'm just looking at the time. We're winding down to 11:30. Are there any other comments from the presenters? Or Jen, I see your hands up.
Thank you for moderating. Thank you.